Well, first, thank you very much for the invitation to talk about my latest work. And today I'm very happy to present about discriminating between theories of the very early universe. And I'll start by talking about what we know of the very early universe with very good certainty. So we have this amazing picture of the cosmic microwave background, which gives us a snapshot of the universe about 300,000 years after a putative Big Bang. And what it shows is small temperature fluctuations across the universe that we now measure with very good precision and accuracy. And we can extrapolate this picture back in time with physics that is now quite well known. And the origin of these temperature fluctuations boil down to a single degree of freedom, known as the primordial curvature perturbation, also called zeta. And we can extrapolate it back to about 10 to the minus 32 seconds after, again, what is believed to be the beginning of time. When we reconstruct the statistics of this variable, we find a very simple picture. It turns out this variable is, to a very good approximation, Gaussian. And in this context, what this means is that all of its statistics is described by its variance. In other words, its two-point correlation function, also known as the power spectrum. Furthermore, this power spectrum is almost scale invariant. So what this means, as we can see from this plot here, on the vertical axis, this is the log of the dimensionless two-point correlation function. And it appears to be in some range here, almost independent of the scale, so almost flat as a function of the Fourier wave number k, which is the inverse of the wavelength of the fluctuations. So that's what we mean by nearly scale invariant. And the fact that it's not exactly flat, but it's slightly tilted, means that this power spectrum has a small red tilt here. It has a bit more power toward the largest scales. So all of the information in this two-point correlation function boils down to a very simple power law, where we have an amplitude and a tilt, a slight deviation from being exactly scale invariant, from being almost independent of the scale, independent of the Fourier wave number k here. And at this point, there's no statistically significant sign of anything else. At least there's no confirmed primordial gravitational waves, no known Gaussianities, running of the spectrum, specific features, and so on. So at this point, it's amazing in a sense that the incredibly rich and complex nature of the CMB boils down primordially to a very simple picture with a single degree of freedom which is described by two numbers. And the question then is, how can we explain that? And the typical strategy is to assume some initial condition for the universe. And in particular, one typically assumes a quantum vacuum on the smallest scales. And then this should undergo some cosmological evolution. And at this point, we don't know what this evolution is. And this evolution should take our assumed initial conditions and bring them to what we measure, what we observe, these final conditions, which are that we have a nearly scale-invariant two-point correlation function on large scales. The evolutionary part is usually tackled by using the linearized Einstein equations. So that's our main tool. And what this gives us is an ordinary differential equation for the curvature perturbation zeta, here written in Fourier space. So k is the wave number, again, of the fluctuations. And this ODE is second order in time, here written as a function of tau, the conformal time. And there are other functions of time that enter that equation. In particular, there's this quantity z, which is a combination of the scale factor, the equation of state of matter, the sound speed, which also enters here. And from that equation, we can see that on the smallest scales initially, when the wave number is very large, we're going to have an oscillatory ODE. So typically the fluctuations are oscillating. And then as they evolve toward the larger scales, we're going to have this term here that's going to be dominant, which will characterize the evolution typically on super horizon scales, and which are going to determine what is the shape of the power spectrum. And since this is a second time derivative of the variable Z divided by itself, we can already see that there are going to be many solutions that will lead to the same results. They're going to have different evolutions that are going to allow to interpolate between the same initial conditions and the same final conditions. Just as an example, as a very simple situation, we can take a unit sound speed and assume a constant equation of state. Then we have a power law solution for the scale factor written that way in conformal time. And from this, we can compute the second time derivative of Z divided by itself, and we get this quantity. And we know that to get approximate scale invariance for the curvature perturbation, this term in the equation of motion has to be approximately equal to 2 divided by tau squared. And we can then ask the question, what values of epsilon are going to give this term? And at this point, there are two solutions. We can either have epsilon very close to 0 or epsilon very close to 3/2. In the first case, this corresponds to inflation, which is what very well known. And we get such an equation state with a negative pressure and moreover, an approximately vacuum equation state. And the other one would correspond to having almost pressureless matter. So that would correspond to having a phase of nearly matter-dominated contraction, which we'll dub just fast contraction. So already we see there are two solutions, but those are perhaps the simplest ones. You could certainly imagine having a time-dependent equation of state or time-dependent sound speed, or moreover, have additional fields at play. And so in that case, it's clear that it opens up many more possibilities. And just as a couple examples, let me mention that one can have slow contraction to contrast with fast contraction. And this is also known as ekphorotic cosmology. In that case, the equation state is very stiff. Epsilon is greater than 3. Or we could also have slow expansion, again, in contrast to fast expansion. And this would, this is also known as genesis. And in that case, the equation state epsilon would actually be negative because the null energy condition would be violated for some period of time. So those are just a few examples. And the point I'm trying to make here is that within the assumptions that are being made for all of them, they can all be made consistent with the measured two-point correlation function. And even I have to stress that this is not exhaustive in any way. One can have even more scenarios, often that go beyond just semi-classical GR. And by that, I mean, you could imagine having really a fully stringy scenario of the early universe, or something that is that involves holography, or that deviates significantly from GR and the gravity sector. It could be conformal gravity. It could be different things. And in all these contexts, there also exist different realizations of the very early universe that would predict a nearly scale invariant two-point function. But for today, I'll keep it relatively simple and just discuss a few of them. And the next question we then want to ask is, well, can we tell apart all of the different scenarios? But first, let me just give you in picture some of the scenarios we have here. So inflation is a standard paradigm. It would start at or near a Big Bang initial singularity, and it would then expand exponentially fast. Whereas a contracting alternative would have a phase of contraction before a bounce, so a transition from contraction to expansion. And slow expansion would correspond to having a universe that is approximately or asymptotically Minkowski in the past, and that would slowly start expanding and transition to the phases of standard Big Bang cosmology at later times. So as I said, then we want to ask the question whether we can tell apart all these different scenarios. and whether we can do it in a way that is where we can say with confidence that some scenario is more likely to have happened than another one. And we can turn to other quantities that we can measure to try to answer this question. So in particular, we could look at the running of the spectral index, alpha s. We could look at non-Gaussianities, the tensor scalar ratio, the tensor tilt, and so on. And I think that if we measure really several of them with great precision and accuracy in the future, it will be already very useful and we'll learn a lot. And surely, in principle, we could tell apart different models at least. But it remains that it's often the case that one can come up with different models that will lead to very degenerate predictions. So all in all, it's very difficult to completely distinguish different scenarios. And just as one example, here let me contrast, say, a particular realization of single field slow roll inflation with a particular realization of a two field ekpyrotic cosmology. So here we could imagine single field inflation with having the usual spectral index, a small negative running, very small local known Gaussianities, small but non-zero tensor to scalar ratio, and almost zero but red tensor tilt. And we could imagine comparing this to, as I said, a model of slow contraction that involves two fields. And this would predict certainly the right red tilt. Depending on how you exactly model this, you would have a running, which would also be negative, just like an inflation, but the exact value would be in the range of 10 to the minus 4 to 10 to the minus 2. So it could certainly be degenerate again with what is obtained in inflation. And regarding non-Gaussianities, in general, it's expected for FNL local to be in the range of minus 5 to 5. And just as an example, depending again on how you actually model it, you could have an expression that has this particular form where here, well, epsilon is the equation of state as before, but kappa 3 is a variable, a parameter that enters in the potential for the theory, and it's a free parameter, and it could certainly be such that one gets an expression for FNL local that is very similar to inflation. And also, I have to say that this is an example of inflation, but there as well, yeah, there are many models that would predict many, many different things. And once again, the point is that one could have very similar predictions. And finally, let's look at the tensor sector. So for ekpyrotic cosmology in general, it would seem to indicate that it has a very blue tilt, which would mean that on observable scales relevant to the CMB, the tensor to scalar ratio would be very, very small, practically unobservable. But again, this is fairly model dependent. One could imagine having something that sources tensor perturbations. And an example of that would be to have gauge field production. And then, as shown by some authors, then you can get an observable tensor to scalar ratio within a range of what is within current constraints and which is observable in the near future, which would have not a blue spectrum, but a significant blue tilt. So here, perhaps this is the place where there would be a bigger chance of really cutting apart those two models. But again, I think all of this, and that's what I want to stress, it's model dependent. And it may remain very hard to confidently discriminate between inflation and ekpyrotic cosmology in that way. And I believe the question remains whether there are ways of really discriminating.
Can you go back? I'm a bit confused about this. So I thought you don't get significant tensors from ekpyrosis. I mean, is it like kind of a like new model of ekpyrosis that gives you tensors?
So yes, but the ekpyrotic part has not changed. What is new is that in these papers by this group, they looked at adding a gauge field sector. And the production of these gauge fields in this curved background then gives a source at second order to the tensor perturbations. as well as the scalar ones. But in the end, depending on how much you have production of gauge fields, you can have a significant tensor power spectrum after all.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what was shown in these papers.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Okay, thanks.
The same thing can happen in inflation. You could have sourced tensor perturbations from gauge field production, and people have looked at this as well. And
so I guess maybe in that sense, then the two are not distinguishable, because I mean, if you want to put them on the same footing, you want to have like the minimal model. And if you add these gauge fields, this the source, I mean, the source gravitational wave production could happen in both of them.
Exactly.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. Right. So what I then want to explore is whether we can discriminate different scenarios in an approach that is as model independent as possible, using both a theoretical perspective and an observational point of view. And at this point, I think, well, it's not necessarily an easy problem, but we have to try it and invent new approaches to address it. And for the rest of this talk, I'm going to propose three avenues, which will involve quantum circuit complexity, quantum transition amplitudes, and finally, standard clocks. So let me start with primordial quantum complexity. So the question we want to address here is, how complex are the various scenarios? And by that, what we'll mean is, if we had access to a full quantum computer and we wanted to do a quantum simulation of the different scenarios of the early universe, how many quantum gates would we need in the quantum computer to do the simulation? So we'll have in mind, starting with an initial state for our primordial fluctuations. And then we evolve this state through our quantum computer such that at the end, our output is the late time large scale perturbations that ultimately lead to the CMB. So as another picture here, we can imagine starting with the vacuum in the circuit, and then the vacuum will go through different quantum gates and evolve such that ultimately we measure the CMB state. In equations, the idea is that we take a reference state and we want to evolve it toward a target state in a unitary manner. And the question of how complex is this quantum simulation, how complex is the circuit, is the question of how many quantum gates, how many elementary quantum gates do we need to construct this unitary operator? What was found in the field of quantum information is that we can provide this quantum circuit with a continuous differential geometry. And then when one does that, the question of what is the optimal quantum circuit, in other words, what is the smallest number of gates to perform the simulation, becomes a question of what is the geodesic in this differential geometry of quantum gates. This was pioneered, as I said, in the field of quantum information back in 2005, but it was then generalized to quantum field theories, particularly by Roe Jefferson and Robert Myers, and by several more authors in the later years. And finally, it was applied in the context of early universe cosmology by this group here in 2020, and then by us. And that's, I'll present these ideas in the next few slides. So the idea is that we start with a reference state and we want to evolve this to a target state. And the assumptions we're going to make here is that both states are going to be Gaussian. So this will be at the level of just Gaussian perturbations. And these states are going to have respective frequencies, small omega and capital omega. We can just think of those as one-dimensional harmonic oscillators, where the position, in other words, would be this variable zeta. And as a toy model, to understand the concept of complexity here, let's really just think of zeta as a position operator, and look at also its conjugate operator momentum, pi here. And let's construct an example of elementary gate, which is just the complex exponentiation of this position and momentum operators, together with a parameter epsilon, sort of a control parameter, for this gate. And then when this operator hits our state psi, what it will do is change the amplitude as well as change the point, the position at which this is evaluated, the state is evaluated, weighted by the exponentiation of epsilon. Then we could imagine having a series of such Q gates, in particular have alpha of them. So we imagine that the unitary evolution will consist of the product of alpha Q gates. And then this unitary evolution will take the reference state to the target state if this equation here is respected. So if 2 times epsilon times alpha is given by the log of the ratio of the frequencies. And then the complexity is just the counting of the number of gates. So it's alpha. And really, one has to also weight it by epsilon to get the limit of zero complexity when there are no gates at all. And the result is simply the log of the ratio of the frequencies. This could also be analytically continued to the complex plane for complex frequencies in more generality. And in such a case, generally, the result would just be the magnitude of the log of the frequencies, the ratio of the frequencies. In cosmology, we'll really have in mind that this reference state, as I said, is the Bunch-Davies initial vacuum, which immediately tells us about the small omega frequency. And then at late times, capital omega, which also has the name of the correlator, is then given by a certain transformation of our curvature perturbation. So one can show how this transformation is obtained by transforming from the Eisenberg picture to the Schrodinger picture when writing down the states in this way. And it simply involves time derivatives and complex conjugation of the curvature perturbation as well as the variable Z that I previously defined. What we found is that there's a very convenient geometry to describe the evolution of the perturbations as a geometry of quantum gates. It was found that when you want to represent Gaussian wave functions as covariant matrices, there's a very natural geometry that comes up. The gates become elements of the group SP2R. And so one has a set of matrices, and one can easily define a metric on the space of quantum gates, and it's found to be the hyperbolic geometry. So one can represent this in different ways. An example would be the Poincaré half plane, where our reference state, the Bunch-Davies vacuum, would be the point 0,1. And this would evolve toward target state at a point xy given by these combinations of the reference frequency and the target frequency, in particular its real part and imaginary part. And also similarly, we can represent this on a Poincaré disk by transforming these XY coordinates in this particular way. And we get this picture on the right here, and that's what I'll focus on. So in this picture, our initial reference state becomes the origin. So it becomes the point 0,0. And the target state that would correspond to the late time correlator will lie at the point 1,0, very close to, closer and closer to the boundary of this hyperbolic geometry. And then as the correlator evolves in this geometry of quantum gates, they'll have different things will happen. In particular, one can have amplification of the state. And this will happen when it's moving along the horizontal axis of this geometry, because along this line, the real part of the correlator is going to 0, and this corresponds to having a growth of the two-point function. Also, when it's moving to the right or along the boundary, one can check that the ratio of the imaginary part to the real part is growing, which corresponds to having classicalization in the WKV sense. So the state is going from a more a quantum state initially toward a more classical state as it approaches the target state. And finally, we can read off the complexity by simply measuring what is the geodesic distance from the origin to the point in the geometry by just using the usual hyperbolic distance formula. The results we get are shown here. So to read this, a person has to say that everything is evolved as a function of time in E folding number, n, and the evolution is happening from the initial small-scale quantum regime toward the large-scale classical regime at late times, and the transition is the horizon exit time. Similarly here, this is color-coded from going starting in the UV and evolving toward more the IR at late times. And again, the transition is the horizon exit time. Let's first look at inflation and what happens there. So one starts at the origin, the bunch daily state. And first, in this geometry, the correlator is evolving to the left, meaning that the state is first being amplified. And this corresponds to the sub-horizon growth of the two-point correlation function. So as we know, it's oscillating, but it's being stretched by just the space stretching happening in inflation. And then it will move along the boundary of the geometry, which represents means that squeezing is happening. So as one approaches horizon exit happens and evolves toward the large scales, the state will get more and more squeezed, meaning more and more classical as it gets closer and closer to the final target state. In comparison, if we look at the contracting alternatives, this is happening very differently. So for both fast contraction and slow contraction, the evolution is all happening toward the right here and along the horizontal axis, meaning that amplification and squeezing are both happening at the same time. And as we notice, also very fast, because all of this evolution here, say for fast contraction, is happening while it's still deeply in the UV, and it quickly gets close to the boundary as it keeps evolving, exits the horizon, and so on. Similarly, for slow contraction, this happens relatively fast. The squeezing and deamplification are happening first already sub-Hubble, and then it gets toward horizon exit and gets, again, more amplified, more squeezed. This is all happening at the same time. And a consequence of that is when we compute the complexity, meaning when we compute the geodesic distance in this Poincaré geometry, we get that at least at late times, there are very different growth rates of this complexity. So this is now what the plot on the right shows. This is the quantum circuit complexity. This now this distance in the hyperbolic disk here. And we see that inflation at late times has the smallest rate, the smallest growth rate of complexity, whereas fast contraction has by far the largest growth rate, and slow contraction is somewhere in between. Sub-Hubble, things are a bit different because here it's not so much how the correlator is evolving. Rather, it's more just the scale factor evolution that affects the evolution of complexity. And we can see that, well, slow contraction, the scale factor is not evolving much, and therefore there's not much growth of complexity. But they show their true nature on super horizon scales. And we can actually quantify this as follows. So for inflation, well, let me first say that in all cases, the change in complexity is always proportional to the change in e-folding number in a linear fashion. And the proportionality constants differ for every scenario here, whether you have inflation or contraction. So for inflation, it's root 2. And the dependence here on epsilon is very small. Typically, this will remain close to 1 for small epsilon. For slow contraction, it's 2 times root 2. And here the dependence on epsilon, again, is very small because for large epsilon, this is approximately 1. And finally, for fast contraction, the result is simply 3 times root 2. So we can really see from there that these complexities really differ from one another in depending on the scenario. And inflation would really be the simplest quantum computer, according to this. It's the one that leads to the least growth of complexity compared to these two alternatives, at least. And for all of them, there's very small model dependence. The expressions we get for the complexity barely depend on how we actually model all of them. There's small dependence on the equation of state, no dependence on, say, the potential of the fields at play and so on. So it really looks like we found a very good theoretical quantity that differentiates the different scenarios. And it describes well the quantum to classical transition of perturbations that is happening in the very early universe. But at this point, this is perhaps just half of the job, in the sense that we would really hope to use this to discriminate the different scenarios. And at this point, this involves really digging a bit more and trying to interpret what this complexity means. And in inflation, there are first indications that complexity has an interpretation of quantum chaos. And there are also connections with black holes in this context. And perhaps it'd be interesting to look at whether there's also a sign of chaos in the alternatives then, and whether this then means that there is some sensitivity to initial conditions in that way. So at this point, I won't claim anything, but I think there are interesting avenues to explore in that direction in the future. Let me now shift gears and move on to primordial quantum amplitudes. So what we wanted to address here is cosmological transition amplitudes that take us from some initial state towards some final state, and use the Lorentzian path integral to evaluate such transition amplitudes. When we do an expansion in small h bar, so it's sort of semi-classical approximation, this will be to leading order given by a sum over relevant saddle points of different normalizations and the exponentiation of the action evaluated on shell, meaning evaluated on solutions to the classical equations in motion that take us from the initial state toward the final state. And here, capital phi would really mean all of the fields at play, including the metric that we would want to quantize, and scalar fields, vector fields, and so on. And what we suggested is that for this to yield a well-defined transition amplitude and that gives non-zero finite probabilities, these relevant saddle points, when evaluated on shell, they better converge. So this on-shell action evaluated from the initial configuration to the final configuration has to be finite. Contributions that are off-shell could still blow up, and that's perfectly fine from a quantum mechanical point of view. In fact, it's expected. But our emphasis is really on the on-shell part. And we can then see how, when we apply this, say, in cosmology, it has direct and important implications. So as an example, let us take the Einstein-Hilbert term in the action, and one such term would then be this combination of the scale factor and its time derivative in FRW. And therefore, the action would involve this particular integral, and we want to evaluate this on shell. So one thing we can do is look at a power law solution for the scale factor that depends on epsilon, this constant equation.
Can I ask you a question? Are you assuming you have a compact space here?
Good question. So, yes. One thing we did is assume that we have a compact space, and therefore the space integral converges, and therefore we focus on the time integral. Mm-hmm. However, let us just say that it's perhaps a bit less clear regarding the spatial part, what matters and what doesn't matter, in a sense that if the space is non-compact and say infinite, well, it's not clear whether this divergence is really physical or not. And so at this point, for simplicity, we'll assume that it's compact and that it converges, and that therefore we can do this calculation. But there's more thinking to be done about the actual significance of a possible divergent non-compact space. And yeah, at this point, I don't have an answer.
But I mean, physically, we know there are things that are very far away in infinite space, but they don't really matter for,
yes,
for what we see.
Yeah.
So you would think that, for physical statements, whether the space is finite or infinite shouldn't matter, basically.
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I would agree with that.
Okay, thanks.
So yeah, here we're going to look at the time integral and evaluate it on shell for such parabola solutions. And then the actual value we'll get depends on what are the integration boundaries. So one example would be to start at zero, the Big Bang, and have expansion. In particular, we could have inflation when this equation is at epsilon is small. Or as another example, we could imagine having a contracting phase prior to a bounce. In that case, the time integration would start at minus infinity, and the equation of state epsilon would be greater than 1. In the first case, this clearly converges. So everything is fine. The on-shell action gives a finite value. And so at this point, we don't worry about that. But regarding a contracting universe, this is not always true. In particular, if the equation of state is like that of matter or radiation, taking this all the way to minus infinity leads to a divergent on-shell action. And therefore, we would claim that this cannot lead to sensible transition amplitudes. The only context where it would converge would be if the equation of state epsilon is greater than 3, which corresponds precisely to slow contraction or kaprotic cosmology. So that would still be fine because the scale factor is contracting so slowly that we can actually integrate it all the way to minus infinity, and it does converge in that case. For inflation, let's come back to it. It turns out it's not that simple. In particular, if really you want to take it all the way to the Big Bang, and assume GR all the way there, which is a big assumption, but if you do that, one can find that there are instabilities that form from interference among different saddle points. And these instabilities then imply that the on-shell actions blow up. And so this would not be viable. Another context in which this is problematic is if inflation is eternal. In that case, the potential is so flat that your scalar field is stochastically jumping up the potential, so that inflation is always happening somewhere in the universe. And we found that in such a context, we actually can find a divergent action. So what this means precisely is that we evaluate on shell the action for GR and a scalar field, and it boils down to the evaluation of the scale factor cube times the potential times the probability that the scalar field is undergoing inflation at a given time. And we can find this by solving the usual Fokker-Planck equation in stochastic inflation. And then this integral diverges precisely when the potential is so flat that eternal inflation happens. And such a bound on the potential is very reminiscent of what is found in the Swampland program. And in fact, there was a recent paper pointing out that perhaps that all of the Swampland conjectures could actually be reformulated or have their origin from a principle of finite amplitudes in quantum gravity. So interestingly, there might be a deeper link between demanding finite quantum amplitudes and things such as the Swan-Plan conjectures in string theory. Another context in which we apply this is quadratic gravity. So our motivation here was that quadratic gravity is supposed to be renormalizable. And so as an effective theory, at least we should be able to trust it to higher energy scales than just GR. And so it's better motivated to look at solutions that approach the Big Bang, for instance. And that's what we did, say, looking at power law solutions that approach the singularity. And in that case, the Onshell action we found converges only when the power is large enough, precisely greater than one, which would mean that only accelerating solutions in quadratic gravity would be allowed. If one generalizes this to include anisotropies, in general, anisotropies blow up quite rapidly in the approach to a singularity. And so we found that only solutions that have bounded anisotropies would satisfy the principle of a finite amplitude. And such solutions do exist in quadratic gravity. For instance, there will be constant Hubble and constant shear of solutions there. We can further generalize this to higher order terms, curvature terms in the theory, say up to the nth power of the Riemann tensor. And there again, we can look at power law solutions in FRW that approach the Big Bang, and their convergence of the amplitudes happens if this power is large enough, and it has to be always has to be larger, the greater the power of the Riemann tensor is in the theory. And in fact, if there's an infinite tower of Riemann tensors, it turns out that no such power law solutions would be allowed at all in the approach to a Big Bang initial singularity according to this principle. So just to summarize it really looks like demanding to have a finite cosmological transition amplitude is a really good way to theoretically discriminate many different models of the very early universe. But at this point, perhaps that it's an approach that is more dependent, model dependent, because you need to provide the actual theory. You need to know what is the action, gravity sector, the matter sector, and so on. And you need to evaluate this on shell for specific solutions that you find. Nevertheless, yes, there's a question.
Yeah, regarding quadratic gravity and higher order gravity, don't you have to worry about known instabilities and ghosts in wider unitarity?
Yeah, so indeed, in quadratic gravity, such as this theory here, you have additional degrees of freedom, in particular, that are ghost-like. And the stance we took is that, well, there are two avenues. Either the ghost is really physical, and it then implies that this theory is not viable in the first place. In particular, it would lead to unstable perturbations that would blow up. And our principle would rule this out, because if you have blowing up and instabilities, it also leads to divergent actions, and therefore it's not admissible. The other point of view that can be taken is that, as some authors argues, that this ghost is not important, it can be dealt with, and the theory is trustable all the way to very high energy scales. And in that case, then I'm listing here some of the conclusions that would be obtained from that. So that's it. For the time that I have, let me now move on to the third part of my talk, which will be about primordial standard clogs. So the idea here is that in the very early universe, one could expect to have a wealth of heavy spectator fields living in the universe at higher energies. This is perhaps best motivated in string theory, where there's supposed to be a landscape, and in which case the field theory would be a complicated space of valleys and mountains. This is perhaps a bit exaggerated, but it paints you a picture. And we could in the very early universe, one could find itself in a particular valley of this field space where one has a field that is slowly rolling and giving rise to the background, whether this is inflation or ekpyrotic cosmology or and so on, and as well as giving rise to the perturbations. But it's not hard to imagine also that this trajectory might not be completely straight, and it would perhaps undergo a turn such that if one is in a valley like this, tangential directions are going to be excited. And as depicted here, the tangential directions are, this would be like a parabola where this would correspond to a heavy field. And the mass squared would be the second derivative of this tangential direction in the potential. And so one could find oneself in a situation where one has the typical background trajectory, which is, as I said, slightly curved such that the tangential direction is excited, which would then lead to oscillations of this heavy field. And if heavy fields are excited as such in the very early universe, we can then expect corrections to the usual correlation functions. In particular, it would lead to oscillatory signals in the different observational windows. And it was actually found that the frequency dependence as well as the amplitude dependence of these oscillatory signals would mainly depend on the background evolution of the universe itself. So, as an example, to be more specific here, what was found is that if you parameterize your background as follows, again, say just a power law for the scale factor that depends on epsilon for a constant equation of state, you can then find a very generic expression for how a heavy field will be oscillating in such a background. And correspondingly, you can then compute what would be the sort of the back reaction on the curvature perturbations, which would lead to a correction to the two-point correlation function compared to the correction that would be oscillating compared to the nearly scale invariant one, which would have no oscillations. And the resulting correction can be expressed as follows. So there's an amplitude that is frequency dependent, and the exact dependence also has a power of epsilon, meaning that already it depends on what is the background that phase. And also the oscillatory part has a frequency that depends again on epsilon. So it depends on what is the background evolution during that phase. Here, M will be the mass of this heavy field, and H star here just means the Hubble parameter evaluated at the onset of these oscillations. And just to depict what these predicted superimposed oscillations look like, we can plot such a function for inflation, contracting scenarios, whether fast or slow, slowly expanding ones, as a function of the Fourier wave number k on a log scale. And we can really see in what sense that having different values of epsilon, having different scale factor evolutions, lead to different behaviors of these superimposed oscillations, particularly regarding the amplitude, which is shrinking toward higher wave number in an expanding universe, whereas it's either almost constant or slowly expanding for contraction. And also the frequency is very, how it changes as a function of k is very different. So here it's more like higher frequency toward lower frequency. And for contracting scenarios, it's the reverse. So lower frequencies toward higher frequencies at higher k. So it really seems to indicate that if one can measure such superimposed oscillations on top of the nearly scale invariant power spectrum, it could really tell us about epsilon and consequently about the scale factor itself of the very early universe. There'll be expected signals in other windows as well, not just in the two-point function, but also the three-point function in the tensor sector and so on. And they're all potentially observable with next generations of telescopes. there's been quite a bit of work in the context of inflation to both construct specific models that incorporate heavy fields, as well as look at just a general predictions. And in particular, this led to the program of cosmological collider physics, which is precisely this idea of looking at what would be the signals in, say, non-Gaussianities of heavy spectator fields of different masses and different spins. And there's also, as I showed, a great prospect of, if we can measure these signals, of telling apart different scenarios. But and let me say that to really test this and also to check that it's really model independent, we have to also build actual models and check what are the predictions there, and therefore to test whether this general parameterized prediction holds or not. And there's been barely any exploration done in the alternatives. So that's what we started looking at together with Jingang Chen and Reza Ebadi. We looked at the first possible implementation of heavy fields in a model of slow contraction. So the way this can be done is just trying to reproduce this picture here, where we would have the typical rolling trajectory, which would then start turning such that a heavy field is excited. So we need a curved field space for all the fields at play. So in particular, the background scalar field. And chi here would be the entropy field that would generate the perturbations in this model of two-field slow contraction. And sigma would be the heavy field that would be excited and lead to the oscillatory corrections. So when sigma is excited, one expects to simply recover its usual the usual Klein-Gordon equation for a heavy field, which would lead to these oscillations with a time-dependent amplitude when the mass is large compared to the Hubble scale. And here I'm showing just an example of how this is really done. So this would be the massive field oscillation evolution, which shows oscillations as a function of the evolving number. And so at first, it's at rest. It's not being excited. And as the coupling starts becoming important, just to excite this direction, the field starts oscillating. And that's what we find here. And it's matching the expected analytical expression up to the point where the mass becomes of the order of the Hubble scale, and this freezes. In turn, this leads to a slight back reaction on the background trajectory, and we can look at this in terms of the change to the equation of state as follows. And we can see that it can lead to order one corrections in epsilon here. And correspondingly, this, as we can see, will lead to changes in the predicted power spectrum. An example in which this can happen is if there's a specific coupling between the heavy field and the isocurvature mode that will then be converted into curvature perturbations. And this type of coupling could certainly come from a general field space. And would imply at second order an interaction Hamiltonian in this specific form. And with this coupling with sigma, it would precisely lead to a correction to the two-point function as given by this expression here. We're currently looking at what are the more general results for what are the predicted corrections to the two-point function and what are the exact signals in that case. But all that I'll say is to stay tuned, because there'll be very exciting results here. So let me summarize. I hope I convinced you that there can be very different realizations of the very early universe that can predict more or less the same two-point correlation function for primordial curvature perturbations. And at that level, we need to come up with new ways to discriminate between the theories in an approach that is as model independent as possible. I discussed three possible avenues. Firstly, quantum circuit complexity, which is a very interesting way of describing the quantum to classical transition that's happening for perturbations in the early universe. And as we found, it appears to be very model independent, which is good, And then the next question, obviously, as I mentioned, is how can this be really applied to discriminate, tell that perhaps such a scenario is under better theoretical control than another one? A second avenue that we explored is that of demanding a finite cosmological transition amplitude. As we saw, this leads to quite strong theoretical constraints on different models that are allowed. But perhaps the downside is this is a bit more model dependent, as we saw. You need to specify what is the full theory and look at specific solutions to tell that this would lead to finite transition amplitudes or not. Finally, I discussed standard clocks, which are heavy spectator fields in the early universe, which would lead to specific observational signals that would allow us to constrain models. And these signals are supposed to be quite model independent and would tell us directly about the scale factor evolution of the early universe. But to really test this model independence and the actual constraining power and how this would be really applied, I think we need to come up with exact models that show us that these predictions are trustable and robust. And in that context, there's a lot more work to be done on the alternatives, but that's something that I'm excited right now. And as I said, I hope you stay tuned to see what we come up with in the near future. So thank you for your attention.
Okay, great. Thanks, Jerome. So let's all unmute to give him a round of applause for his very nice talk. Okay, so we had a couple of questions, but are there any further questions for Jerome? Feel free just to jump in, or if you are shy, you can raise your hand and then I can call on you.
I have a question.
Okay, John, yeah, go ahead.
Getting back to your path integral formulation, perturbation theory.
The what? Sorry, I can't hear you very well.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah. Getting back to your path integral formulation.
Yes.
Generally, we have to worry about whether the path integral is well defined. For example, in standard quantum field theory, when we calculate loops.
Yes.
It's only well defined. We use Euclidean space, both momentum and configuration.
Mm-hmm.
But then it's well defined. So maybe this gets back to the question by Niyoshi as to whether the space is compact or not, but it's more than that, it has to be Euclidean.
Right. So the approach we wanted to take is in the spirit of the series of works that have been done by Neil Turok, Jean-Luc Lenas, and Job Felbrugge, who developed a way of really computing Lorentzian path integrals precisely in the context of quantum cosmology. And there is a well-defined strategy to compute these Lorentzian path integrals, which is certainly different than the Euclidean ones. Surely it's a field in which I believe people do not... Not all people agree with what are the correct results. But in a way, this is, I won't say that this is independent, but we're asking something much more simpler. And all that we're asking is that if you look at the leading order term, and we're ignoring loops completely, because as I said, loops could certainly diverge, and that's fine. One would expect to renormalize the theory and so on. But Unshell, just this should converge. And I believe this should be also true with a Euclidean path integral. Because if the Unshell action diverges in that case, it would predict zero probabilities and vanishing amplitude. So that is the statement we started with.
Of course, the tree graphs are just classical.
Yes.
The quantum comes in through the loops. So if it's just classical, you're okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay, Nyash, go ahead.
Okay, thank you. So thanks, Tom. A very interesting talk. So I guess I have, Minister did just hit this slide. I have a little bit of trouble with this because, I mean, as you mentioned, so what happens if S on shell goes to, I mean, does go to infinity, either in the Euclidean or Lorentzian one, I mean, it just means that you, your that saddle point becomes irrelevant. But that doesn't mean that, I mean, I guess what I'm thinking is, it just means that there's nothing wrong with that theory, just something wrong with that saddle point, right? So there could be elsewhere in the theory where, I mean, something interesting is happening.
Right, so I guess, so say we take these examples here, this would correspond to the real classical saddle point. And yeah. If we say that this saddle point should be irrelevant, then they are, well, perhaps there are other saddle points, but then they would be completely different and would not correspond to inflation and contracting the universe that are real and...
Right, but I guess the point is there could be, I mean, divergences coming from some parts of your trajectory. It just means that those parts are not important for your for the full path. Because basically, I mean, usually this happens when you do a path integral. If you have fast oscillations, they cancel. So it could be that you have a saddle point, but in some places, or saddle point trajectory, classical trajectory, but some places basically S starts oscillating very rapid or changing very rapidly. It just means that those parts are not important because they just they cancel each other. Mm-hmm. But the rest of the saddle, the rest of the trajectory could be fine. It's just those regions where the oscillation is happening is, but they become irrelevant, right?
Right. Yeah. I see what you mean. I just have a difficulty of seeing situations that we looked at where this would still allow the Lorentzian space-time.
No, I see what you're saying. These are all multiplied ways. So if there is a fast oscillating part, I guess that would multiply the rest of its time. So then the whole thing just becomes irrelevant. Maybe yeah. that's a good.
Yeah. Another thing that I'll say is that you're right on one thing, is that sometimes there can be divergent parts of the action which essentially cancel one another. And we actually found situations where that happens. And and I agree with you, this is allowed and this is fine. But there are cases where it doesn't necessarily happen exactly, and that there still are divergences. And yeah, our claim is that this is then a sign of a pathology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Quick comment.
Go ahead.
How far can you push back these formulations? For example, the path integral formulation back near to the Big Bang.
Yeah.
And expect it to be classical tree craft.
Yeah. So that's certainly a good point. And we are completely transparent about that. And indeed, if you want to look all the way to, say, the Big Bang, then this implies that you're trusting your theory all the way to that point. And I don't think this is fully, I don't think this is physical. Nevertheless, we wanted to as a first approximation, we wanted to look at what are the implications with this big caveat. Let me say that, As I already mentioned, this was the motivation for looking at different theories, in particular, something like a theory that would have, say, an infinite tower of curvature corrections, which in principle could be well-defined to describe the physics all the way to infinite energies. But already there, of course, this was a very simplified situation, which is parallel solutions. But we found there that this would not lead to convergent transition amplitudes. Another context that I can comment on, something like a contracting universe all the way to minus infinity in time, this is fully in the realm of classical GR. and that conclusion would hold. The newer physics would happen, say at a possible bounds, but the resulting transition amplitude up to some finite time in the contracting phase doesn't depend on that. So the conclusion holds regardless.
Paul Steinhardt claims that the eternal inflation leads to a multiverse, which then makes it difficult to test this theory. What do you think about that? That's because he prefers bouncing universe, of course.
Yeah, and I hope I'll start by saying that I don't want to prefer anything over anything else here. I'm just trying to be as objective as possible and try to see what are the implications in terms of physical criteria that I'm going to come up with and see what is preferred according to these criteria, both theoretical and observational. Now, regarding eternal inflation here, whether it implies that whether it's testable or not, I won't comment. But what I'll say is that the criterion we came up with, when applied to this context, seems to imply that transition amplitudes would be ill-defined. And correspondingly, it would mean that we could not observe anything with finite probabilities, and then therefore we ruled out. But I think the point of view is different.
Okay, we're 10 past. So in view of the time, maybe let's stop here. So thanks again, Jerome, for your very nice talk.